This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 4th of March, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, in Libya, forces loyal to Colonel Gaddafi launch a fierce assault on the town of Zawiya. We assess the state of the uprising.
These people who have been kidnapped, the belief is that they're being used as a human shield to protect against foreign surgical strikes.
We'll take a look at how US aid connects to the violence in Mexico, where last year a record-breaking 15,000 people were murdered. And on Capitol Hill, lawmakers move to strip the EPA of regulatory authority over greenhouse gas emissions. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Environmental activist Tim DeChristopher has been convicted on two felony counts by a Utah jury. In what supporters refer to as an act of civil disobedience, in 2008, DeChristopher bid on more than $1 million in oil and gas leases near Utah's national parks. DeChristopher argues that the leases were being offered illegally by the Bush administration. During the trial, hundreds have rallied at the courthouse in DeChristopher's support, and after the ruling on Thursday, more than 50 supporters flowed out of the courtroom, taking positions with signs and banners on the outside steps. Video by the Salt Lake Tribune. The jury convicted DeChristopher of interfering with a government auction. He spoke to his supporters following the verdict, saying the government was pressuring him to feel like a little finger, all alone and easily broken.
All those authorities in there wanted me to think like a finger, but our children are calling to us to think like a fish. And we know that now I'll have to go to prison. We know that now that's the reality, but that's just the job that I have to do. That's the role that I face, and many before me have gone to jail for justice, and if we're going to achieve our vision, many after me will have to join me as well.
DeChristopher now faces up to 10 years in jail and $250,000 fine. His sentencing is scheduled for June 23rd. Two natural gas drilling companies in north-central Arkansas agreed to temporarily abandon hydraulic fracking injection wells at an emergency meeting today. As FSRN's Malcolm Glover reports, those wells have been blamed for recent seismic activity in the area.
Officials with the Arkansas Oil and Gas Commission and geologists say they found a link between two injection wells and more than 800 earthquakes that have rocked Arkansas in the last 6 months. The wells are used to dispose of wastewater from the fracking process deep underground. Both Chesapeake Energy and Clarita Operating Company voluntarily agreed to shut down the wells until a March 29th commission meeting. Chesapeake spokesman Danny Game says his company will bring its own experts to that hearing.
We do not agree with the conclusions. We believe there's a lot of natural seismicity in this area, and there's a lot more subsurface data. We just are looking forward to the opportunity for a much more thorough evaluation of all of that.
At the late March meeting, the commission will also decide whether to extend a moratorium on new wells put in place in January. Malcolm Glover, FSRN, Little Rock.
The unemployment rate in the U.S. dropped to 8.9% in February, and the economy added 192,000 jobs, according to data released today by the Labor Department. This is the lowest unemployment rate since 2009. The number of people who are employment-stressed, working part-time for economic reasons, and others marginally attached to the labor force fell to 15.9%, the lowest that number has been since April 2009. Harvard University administration today signed an agreement formally reinstating the military's Reserve Officer Training Program, or ROTC, after more than 40 years. FSRN's Chuck Rosina has the story.
ROTC was first kicked off the Harvard campus back in 1969 during student protest of the Vietnam War. In recent years, the university refused to reinstate the program because of the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. Harvard argued that endorsing ROTC on campus would be a violation of its own non-discrimination policy. Recognition for ROTC at Harvard will resume when the law is officially repealed. In a statement, University President Drew Faust said, quote, "Our renewed relationship affirms the vital role that the members of the armed forces play in serving the nation and securing our freedoms, while also affirming inclusion and opportunity as powerful American ideals." Under the agreement, Harvard will take financial responsibility for the program, give a Navy ROTC director an office on campus, and allow cadets access to school facilities for ROTC training. Although openly gay and lesbian individuals will be able to serve after top government officials certify the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the new policy does not apply to trans and intersex individuals. Marco Chan of the Harvard College Queer Students and Allies told the campus paper that because of this, the law still violates the school's non-discrimination policy. The student group is planning to protest the decision outside President Faust's office this afternoon. Chuck Rosina, Free Speech Radio News, Boston.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Libya, forces loyal to Colonel Gaddafi have been attacking the oil town of Zawiya. There are multiple reports of many dead and dozens injured. Meanwhile, in Tripoli today, after Friday prayers, protesters were dispersed with tear gas. Our sources say that most internet and phone communication with Libya has been cut off since last night. So for more, we go to Rehab Elhaj, a Libyan-American in Washington, D.C. She's co-founder of the New Libya Foundation, and she's monitoring the situation in Libya. Her friends and family are in Tripoli. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Danny.
Those protests after Friday prayers were dispersed with tear gas. That must be some concern to you, but I understand you haven't been able to get through to your family there to confirm what's going on exactly.
That's right. We haven't been able to get through to anybody.
Do you feel the situation in Tripoli has changed at all in the last few days?
In Tripoli, they feel sort of a sense of helplessness. And they also know that the media isn't permitted to explore the entire Tripoli area. They're sort of confined to certain areas which have been very carefully cleaned. And I guess you can say all evidence of any type of conflict has been removed. There's also been a concerted effort to hide the bodies of people who have perished in this conflict. We created a list online of those who've perished in this conflict, like they did in Egypt, and we've been told that the families of the people on this list have been threatened for making up lies against the regime, accusing the regime of killing their family members. And so they've been threatened with further attacks towards any remaining children and family. And now they're very scared to talk to anybody outside of the country and to share information about what's happened inside. So as these events have been unfolding and as this type of pressure has been mounting on them, they're starting to call out for international intervention. They really are seeing how this regime is going to unknown lengths and extremes that nobody's ever seen before.
When you say foreign intervention, the international response has been debated a lot in the last week. Sanctions are already going into place now, discussion of enforcing a no-fly zone. But what do your friends and family actually want in terms of civil or military help?
The first thing they do want is a no-fly zone. This would, number one, stop the arrival of, I guess you could say, equipment that the regime is using against people. It will stop the arrival of foreign mercenaries, as well as the transfer of troops from one city into the next. So this is number one for Libyans. It'll also kind of tie the regime's hands as far as aerial bombardment is concerned.
You mentioned that you're keeping a list of the people who are going missing and the people who have died in Tripoli. Can you give us a sense of how many people you think have been casualties of this uprising and the brutal repression so far?
The lowest confirmed numbers we've heard was 3,000. Confirmation from families, etc. Between the missing and the conflicts today, it's probably more like 6,000 is the number we're starting to come to terms with.
Those numbers are quite shockingly high. The friends and family you're in contact with and the people who are providing those numbers, where are they getting them from? Presumably from hospitals and morgues?
Exactly. There have also been a great deal of kidnappings in the last 2 to 3 days. People who are targeted for kidnappings, they're threatening people who are speaking to the media. They're threatening people who are speaking to the east of the country, which is liberated. We've gotten everything from human shields, and the belief is that they're being used as a human shield to protect against foreign surgical strikes.
The situation you're describing there contrasts quite markedly with what's going on in Benghazi, which was liberated surprisingly early. There's even a transitional national council that's been set up there. Would your family and friends in Tripoli and other places identify with that transitional national council? Is it regarded as a potential leader of an alternative government to Gaddafi?
Yeah, the transitional national council has done a remarkable job of being very careful not to call themselves a government. They're simply a council, and what they're doing is selecting people in other cities as heads of their local council. And these people emerge sort of organically through a leadership process that they've been engaging in the liberation of their city. And so a lot of these people are also the heads of cities that have been selected for these local councils are judges and lawyers and mostly professionals. They're also working together to send these forces to cities where Gaddafi has been targeting. For instance, Gaddafi's regime has been trying to reclaim cities that were lost to the people. These cities specifically are Zawiya and Brega. These cities have oil reserves, and they have been sending their troops to protect these liberated cities from Gaddafi's forces.
Rihab El-Haj, Libyan-American, co-founder of the New Libya Foundation, based in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Danny. It was my pleasure.
Protests continue in other countries as well. In Baghdad, Basra, Nineveh, and other cities across Iraq, thousands of people have defied a government ban and heavy security to rally for the second Friday in a row to demand political reforms. In Yemen, in the town of Haf Sufyan, Reuters, citing witnesses, reports that the armed forces have fired on thousands of anti-government protesters, killing at least two. And in the town of Sohar in Oman, about 2,000 people have protested over low wages and corruption. Reports suggest dozens of people may have died in demonstrations there during several weeks of unrest. President Barack Obama met with his Mexican counterpart Felipe Calderón yesterday for a high-level summit on bilateral relations. The outcome of the summit was not surprising and included White House praises for what amounts to Calderón's militarization of large swathes of Mexico under the mantle of fighting organized crime.
I have nothing but admiration for President Calderón in his willingness to take this on. The easy thing to do would be for him to ignore the corrosive, corrupting influence of these drug cartels within Mexico. That would be the easy thing to do. He's taking the hard path, and he's shown great courage and great risk in doing so. And the United States will support him in any ways that we can in order to help him achieve his goals, because his goals are our goals as well. And they should be the goals of the Mexican people.
But not all of the Mexican people share the goals outlined by the United States, and Mexico is experiencing some of the worst violence since the end of its revolution. Reporter Shannon Young brings us the voices of people from Chihuahua, the state most impacted by the militarized drug war.
A record-breaking 15,000 people died in Mexico last year within the context of the militarized drug war, bringing the overall four-year total to around 35,000 murders. In researching her book on the hidden victims of the drug war, investigative reporter Marcela Turati noticed some clear trends in areas most affected by the violence.
First, there's the phenomenon that's been seen in many cities, that of fear. There are increasingly more walls being built because people feel unsafe in their own neighborhoods. They stop using public spaces, they stop socializing with their neighbors. Before, people would come to things like funerals, but now there's the fear that the person killed may have been up to something, or someone may come and kill the people who showed up to support the family. The first casualty of this fear is the loss of the community bond in a given area.
Durati has seen this firsthand in her native state of Chihuahua, home to Ciudad Juarez. The U.S. press often describes the violence in Juarez as the product of a three-way battle between rival cartels and federal forces. But a large number of civilians and activists have also been killed. Take the case of the Reyes Salazar family from the nearby rural area known as the Juarez Valley. Six members of the outspoken family of activist Josefina Reyes have been killed in less than 3 years. Some residents of Ciudad Juarez, like Julian Contreras, say militarization has fueled the spike in violence and that federal authorities are ignoring or committing crimes against the civilian population.
En una ciudad completamente militarizada,
in a city that's completely militarized, killers are never arrested. Never. In the case of the Juarez Valley, where the Reyes Salazar family is from, there's only one road that goes into and out of the town, and there are military checkpoints at each end. It's totally controlled by the military. How is it possible for armed convoys to be driving around with high-caliber firearms reserved for military use only without them realizing it? In this case, the only explanation is collusion at the very least. And in other cases, there's direct participation of the army and federal police in this extermination campaign against the lower classes. I'd go as far as to say that it's cheaper for the Mexican government to use the pretext of this war on drugs to kill the poor than to end poverty.
It's become common to read crime reports of violence committed by armed commandos in ski masks. It's impossible to identify who these criminals are, but Ciudad Juarez residents who spoke to FSRN use the terms paramilitaries and death squads to describe them. Overall, an estimated 230,000 people have left Ciudad Juarez since 2008. Census data released Thursday shows roughly a quarter of all homes in Juarez now stand vacant. But it's not just the fear of death that is causing the displacement. Violence and extortion have also caused many businesses to shut down or leave the area, which has put people out of work and caused the city's economy to crumble. Many human rights organizations have identified the Mérida Initiative as a big factor in the violence. The $1.2 billion U.S. taxpayer-funded package largely consists of equipment and training for the Mexican military and police forces. As is the case with Plan Colombia, much of the money goes directly to U.S.-based weapons manufacturers. Juarez youth activist Adrian Fuentes Luján says that if peace is the priority, the U.S. should reevaluate policies ranging from military aid to drug prohibition to trade agreements.
The United States needs to stop sending weapons. We don't want them here. We don't want any more blood. Mexicans are the ones dying in this. We want them to review their drug prohibition policies because the big part of the demand for drugs comes from the U.S. And there needs to be a more just economic relationship between the countries. And the Mexican people are starving due to this economic system, which has an effect of pushing people into crime.
All three of the people interviewed for this story say some local groups are doing important work to create educational and cultural opportunities to maintain a sense of community. But these small-scale efforts can only go so far in the face of policies and practices tearing into the area's social fabric. Shannon Young, FSRN.
This week, the British government announced its new foreign aid budget, a model adopted by other countries. But recipients of the aid are starting to resist the British policy. George Lavender reports.
Since 1997, the UK's Department for International Development has been responsible for an aid budget of over $14.5 billion a year.
It's presented very, very positively, and there's often far less criticism and critical analysis of DFID as there is of other government departments, and certainly a lot less than other parts of British foreign policy.
Richard Whittle has just published Dodgy Development, a book of interviews with people who have been affected by British aid in India.
But what this hides is there's a significant amount of resistance to its work and the model of development that it's promoting.
The Indian government has received more than $1.5 billion a year from Britain in the last 5 years. This has been described as part of the partnership between Britain and India. But many say that this funding is not neutral.
Throughout all the aid programmes is the assumption that what works best is the market and a more business-like model of running services, running the economy, and for people to run their own livelihoods.
In the state of Madhya Pradesh, almost $100 million has been spent on a rural livelihoods project. Part of the project has been promoting the growth of the Jatropha plant, which is farmed for biofuel. Sachin Jain works with the Right to Food campaign in Madhya Pradesh.
Biofuel production is something which is very much linked to the market and to whom it is going to support, for whom actually you want to produce biofuel. For Indian people, at this moment of time, land is more important for the food production.
Sachin Jain says that the UK's development programme has influenced local and national decision-making, and others agree. Richard Whittle says that in places like the eastern state of Orissa, the Department for International Development and World Bank were involved in changing government policy.
Ziafadi and the World Bank came in after a fiscal crisis and, quote-unquote, encouraged the government to undertake a programme to reform the business and direction of government as a condition of the money coming in.
Since then, multinational mining corporations have attempted to exploit Orissa's considerable mineral resources, but so far local people have successfully resisted attempts to force them from their land. Again, Sachin Jain with India's Right to Food campaign.
There is resistance, and in certain parts of Madhya Pradesh also, in Orissa, in different states, actually, there is opposition for the larger policies. We have not seen these international aid institutions taking any kind of a stand in favour of people.
Announcing the new aid budget this week, the British government indicated that in future, aid would be more closely connected with British security and business interests abroad. George Lavender, FSRN, London.
The three-week-long occupation of Wisconsin's state capital has finally come to an end. Last night, a judge ordered the protesters to vacate the capital overnight. This followed a march by thousands of nurses and union supporters pressing for no more concessions to the governor. Molly Stentz and Joanne Powers have the story for Madison.
Over 7,000 people marched to the state capitol Thursday night in what they called a funeral procession for workers' rights. They carried large coffins through the center of town and called for unions to stop giving in to the demands of the Walker administration. They reject the argument that the problem is out-of-control public worker benefits. They arrived to find the Capitol on lockdown, as it has been for 4 days.
Our house! We're still locked out! Our house! We're still locked out!
One of the marchers was Jack Trudell, a nurse at the UW hospital. He says he never agreed to the increased health care and pension payments many unions conceded last week, and thinks the budget bill should tax corporations instead.
I think it's not only an insult to every union worker, but it's really an insult to everybody in the state of Wisconsin. From the beginning, I've been totally against not just the part of the bill that denies collective bargaining, but against the concessions and take back in pay for those of us who actually contracted for pension contributions and health care contributions from our employer.
Support for Wisconsin workers has poured in from around the country, including from community organizer and former Green Party vice presidential candidate Rosa Clemente. She says that grassroots actions are the key to winning working people's demands.
Forget the voting, because you didn't vote to take this over. You did not push a button. You organize, you mobilize, you are showing Ohio, Indiana, Florida, New York, what is possible with a multiracial working people's movement. Because there is no more middle class in this country. There is no middle class. Let's drop that right now. There's the super rich and elite, and there's us, the people.
After 3 days of court hearings over access to the Capitol, a local judge ruled in favor of protesters, but also ordered them to leave the building at night. He found the lockdown unconstitutional, but also found protesters staying overnight to be in violation of state law. He praised the protesters and declared the Capitol open to the public for normal daytime business hours beginning next week. Protesters were immediately asked to leave, and all did so willingly by 10 p.m. C.J. Terrell was one of the last remaining protesters to leave the Capitol peacefully when served the court order by police.
I've been living now at the Capitol for 17 days and just exited. I'm glad we got to leave on the terms we did. We left on the terms that this is the people's house and it will never be shut down like that again. And we left on the terms that we'll be back until this bill is killed.
Capitol access is restricted again today, but protesters continue to rally and sleep outside. Large demonstrations are again planned for Saturday and Sunday. Governor Walker has said he plans to lay off 1,500 state employees by the end of the month if his budget repair bill is not passed. With Joanne Powers, I'm Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
On Capitol Hill, a controversial House bill introduced Thursday would take away the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gases. This comes as today the agency held its final public meeting for companies and the public to weigh in on new greenhouse gas standards. Michael Lawson has more.
At a public meeting in Washington, members of the Sierra Club read statements from people affected by production of fossil fuels.
Landrum is convinced that the toxic environment of her neighborhood contributed to their illness and subsequent deaths. 10 people on my block have died of cancer in the last decade, Landrum explains.
Teresa Landrum, a Detroit resident, lost her mother, father, and brother to cancer and is herself a cancer survivor. Landrum grew up and currently lives in the shadow of a Marathon oil refinery. The EPA is in the development process of updating Clean Air Act pollution standards to reduce greenhouse gas pollution from fossil fuel power plants and petroleum refineries. But a bill introduced in the House would permanently block the EPA's ability to implement such a plan. Industry officials say much of what companies are already required to do under the Clean Air Act has reduced carbon emissions and that specific greenhouse gas regulation would be unnecessary. Steve Cousins, Vice President of Government Affairs for Lion Oil Company, testified that his company has already reduced emissions by nearly 75% over the past 15 years. He says compliance with existing Clean Air Act regulations have unintended consequences.
We have been in a situation where we're to comply with those regulations, we've increased our carbon dioxide output quite a bit. We kind of feel like we're in a position of having our doctor telling us to gain weight and lose weight at the same time.
Democratic Representative Dan Boren of Oklahoma signed on to the Republican plan and has accused the EPA of trying to legislate. He and other critics say the EPA is overreaching its authority in trying to regulate carbon emissions. John Walk of the Natural Resources Defense Council disagrees. He says the public is behind the Clean Air Act, and the Supreme Court has already deemed carbon emissions harmful and thus given the authority to regulate them.
NRDC has done polling and confirmed what most of us believe, which is that there is overwhelming support by the American people, 70% and higher depending upon the state, to allow EPA to do its job.
Republican James Inhofe introduced similar legislation in the Senate, stripping the EPA of its ability to regulate greenhouse gases. Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia has also introduced a measure that would merely delay revised rules by 2 years. Comment on updating Clean Air Act pollution standards will run through March 18th. New standards are expected to be issued in May and November of 2012. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
And that's the program for today and this week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Scott Pham and Jane Chang. Thanks to KPFA, Nathan Moore, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.